The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you all for being here. I've been very excited about this for a while. I totally won this conference by getting to have a conversation with somebody who, without whose work mine wouldn't exist. So many of us in this room would not have figured out how to think about social movements, how they take power, how they lose power, how we get it back. And so I wanted to start out by, we're in a very weird political moment. It feels up and down all the time. And I wanted to start out by just asking your thoughts about this sort of crisis moment we find ourselves in and the opportunities.
Well, but first, Sarah, I want to say how glad I am to be here. Because it really is a very dark and uncertain moment in American politics and world politics. And it's a time where the forces of reaction, of cruelty, of imperialism, of war making are on the move everywhere. And at times like this, we need to be with each other, we need to be on the move, but we need the support and encouragement that we get from standing shoulder to shoulder with people like us. So thank you for being here. You know, it's a very dangerous moment. I probably don't have to put that into words. Everybody knows it. We get up in the morning and we go to our computers to see what horrendous thing has happened since we last looked at the screen or clicked on our phones. I've been around a long time, and I have to say, I've never seen a period quite as dismal as this. I don't want to leave it at dismal. Don't worry, I won't. Quite as dismal, but also quite as uncertain as this. You know, professionally, I'm a political scientist, and political scientists pretend to be able to show you the patterns in political development, which should lead you to understand what's gonna happen next. No one knows what's gonna happen next. There's a little bit of a glimmering light to that, because it also means that maybe we can affect what happens next. But still, I wouldn't understate how dangerous this moment in American politics, and because we're the most powerful, we're the imperial center of the world, how dangerous this moment is for the entire world, for humankind. Very dangerous. And that's important to remember, because it makes it more urgent to try to stop the politics that is making it so uncertain and so dangerous. Stopping what's happening has become very, very important, I think. Just think about it. The almost total official power of a right-wing, partially lunatic, but partially incredibly greedy and short-sighted Republican Party now controls the Supreme Court, the presidency, the Congress of the United States. They also control the major branches of a majority of the state governments of the United States. Their control of the court is likely to last for decades. And behind this apparatus of formal power, there are unhinged business interest groups that are on the war path, as we have not seen for many decades in the United States. I am talking about fossil fuel interests that are determined to get the stuff out of the ground before global warming and the people destroyed by global warming stop them. They want it now. And I'm also talking about financial chicanery and the banking interests behind financial chicanery that are also, they're on such thin ice that they're not planning for their grandchildren. They want to grab it now, and they are very dangerous. And that dangerousness, that predatory, risk-prone character is reflected in the political apparatus that they sustain and fuel with their money. So we have to stop them. Before we do anything else, we have to stop them. It's a political crisis. And stopping them means, I think, joining with the forces of resistance that are already emerging in the United States and elsewhere. Now, a large part of that resistance is in the movements, you know, all kinds of movements, from Me Too, the Me Too movement. They're not calling themselves socialists, most of them, but some of them are. Some of them are, and some of the people who are trying to move into electoral politics are calling themselves socialists now. But, you know, some people say that the other side of the dark side of the Trump era is, in fact, the strength and vigor of the resistance. I don't know if I would trade one for the other, but there is a resistance, and the resistance, with its huge contingent of women, women on the move, this is so encouraging. The resistance is really very important. Perhaps the main thing that we have to rely on to stop them, because we have to stop them before we can reverse the policy changes they've set in motion.
I was gonna sort of go back and ask you to talk about, in talking about how you actually stop them, how you disrupt these processes. People in this room are probably pretty familiar with your classic book, Poor People's Movements, and if you're not, you can buy it here and she will sign it for you. But sort of restate the argument of that book, the way that people's movements can actually disrupt things and halt damage.
You know, usually to stop the regime in power and then to build a better society, we need power, don't we? Well, usually when people think about power, they think about power as a result of resources and individual attributes. Power because you're such a good speaker, you're so good looking, you have a whole bunch of money, you can hire and fire a lot of people, you can buy a lot of propaganda. Those are real sources of power. But there's another kind of power that almost never gets mentioned. And that's the kind of power that resides in the cooperative relations of society, in the institutionalized cooperation of society. We live in families. We live in communities, we go to schools, we go to work, we produce things, we have a store, we have a commons. Those are networks of cooperation. The networks of cooperation are not all as pretty as the commons, the school, the family. The networks of cooperation include the biggest businesses, the biggest financial firms that are strangling entire nations. But all of these social institutions are networks of cooperation. And networks of cooperation reach very far into the society. They involve all of us. You get up in the morning, you go get your bagel and coffee, for some of you, the nanny comes to take care of the children. The person who serves you the coffee and toasts the bagel, is cooperating with you. You're giving them money. The nanny is coming, taking care of your children. Now, those are not egalitarian relations, but they are cooperative relations. And they involve everybody. When you went to get the coffee, you had to cross the street. You cooperated by crossing the street at the light. That also was cooperation. And the car drivers cooperated by stopping their cars at the light. Also cooperation. Now, everybody has to cooperate, or not cooperate, but they also have the ability to not cooperate, to break the rules, to perhaps make demands, have aspirations, to wonder about a better society, and to gather together and refuse to cooperate. Now, from time immemorial, the left has been preoccupied with a form of refusal which illuminates human history. And that form of refusal is the strike. It's collective refusal to cooperate. We think of it as located in industrial mass production. Industrial workers go out on strike. But all sorts of people have the ability to drag their heels and to not cooperate and to collectively not cooperate. You know, I think the most penetrating historians of the Civil War in the United States point to the refusal of plantation slaves to function, to do the economic work on the plantation toward the end of the Civil War as the definitive thrust against the Confederacy. The Union won the war because enslaved Southern blacks refused to cooperate with the plantation economy. So, movements do a lot of things. They have banners, we have songs. At this conference, you have great chants. Really great. So movements are a lot of noise. They make noise. They have spectacles. They bring together great crowds of people. And that's what we think of usually when we think of movements. We think of crowds and noise and so forth. But movements also involve this incredible activation of the power of refusal of ordinary people. And that isn't so noisy, necessarily. Sometimes it is. Sometimes there are noisy picket lines, but it can be very quiet. So, what was your question?
I think you answered it. About the argument at the core for people's movements. But that gives me a segue into one of the specific ones I wanted to ask you to talk about was the welfare rights movement, which you were involved in, and the attacks on welfare that really laid the groundwork for the kind of Republican Party that we see in charge of Congress now.
Yeah, well, in the 1960s, I worked at a poverty program called Mobilization for Youth on the Lower East Side. And I got to spend a lot of time on the streets and in the community rooms and so forth. And I also had certain obligations and one to the project. And one of them was, you know, I'm a social scientist, was to evaluate what one of their programs was doing, how they were doing it. They had service centers in storefronts, three of them, on the Lower East Side. And in those service centers, there were social workers seated behind wooden tables. And nobody exactly was sure what were the social workers doing. And the community came into the storefronts, people from the community, and they spoke to the social workers. But we had to do reports to the Ford Foundation or NIMH or whatever on what we were doing. So we made up a little form. And the form asked, well, what did the person come in for and what did you do? It wasn't very sophisticated social science. So the answers were the person came in because they couldn't pay the rent or buy clothing for the kids when school started, and so we helped them get on welfare. Well, we looked at a lot of these forms and we began to wonder why these people who were apparently eligible for welfare, because the social workers got them on welfare, why they weren't on welfare to begin with. And that made us look at survey data from the first the Lower East Side, then New York City, then other cities. And we came to the sort of seat of the pants conclusion that only one out of three of the people eligible for welfare were actually receiving it. So we began to talk to people about organizing welfare recipients, and that put us in touch with a lot of sort of emerging welfare recipient organizations in New York, in Philadelphia, in Cleveland, and other cities in the country. And we proposed that we launch a campaign to demand full benefits from the welfare department. And we had an analysis of why that might work, of the kinds of pressures that such a campaign in the early 1960s would create for the National Democratic Administration, and how those pressures might ricochet up through the federal system. But once you work with people, you form bonds to them, and friendships, and loyalties. And I care a lot about the fate of poor women, even especially because I think at that time the women's movement, the second women's movement, was emerging. And it was not a movement of poor women at that point in time. And that really was very important to me, and it was very important to the women in welfare rights who felt rejected by the early feminist movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and so, well, there's a few places I want to go there, but I do want to talk about the way you've also written extensively, I'm in the middle of reading Regulating the Poor again, about the way that relief programs have been used to discipline people, to move them into the workforce when there's need for it. And I'm thinking about a lot lately about the way that welfare reform, which they keep saying they're going to do again now, in the 90s, moved a lot of poor women into low-wage work in fast food restaurants, and then what we're seeing over the last several years is a movement of workers in low-wage jobs in fast food restaurants. And so...
Well, you know, I think there is a tradition on the left which has great confidence in workers and believes that if women on welfare became workers, then they would become politicized members of unions, members of the proletariat, and develop a political capacity that they don't otherwise have. I haven't seen evidence of that.
Well, and that also assumes that there's only one kind of work and that the work they're already doing.
Yeah, women on welfare would say, I've been working all my life.
That's right.
And, you know, I think I deserve a break. Yeah. I deserve a benefit check. I deserve some help raising these kids. Yeah. And you know, they do try to raise the kids. So, for, you know, about 15 years, I was very immersed in the welfare rights movement. And I still have friends from that period. And I think they were right. And they've suffered since that time. They and the people who, in a sense, replaced them in the ranks of the poor, of the American poor, the treatment of the poor since the 1960s, since they were really on the march, since they were politicized, after they began to think that they had rights and that they could occupy welfare centers to fight for those rights. There was, of course, a backlash, just as there was for the larger Black freedom movement, because the welfare rights movement was only part of the Black freedom movement, after all. And the backlash meant that people were smashed down when they tried to make demands, that they were isolated from each other. But most horrible, they were demeaned and ridiculed by presidents of the United States.
Many of them.
Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and even Bill Clinton. This is truly irresponsible leadership. And not only were they berated and denigrated with language from the White House, but there was cut after cut to the programs on which they depended. Welfare, one of the achievements of the welfare rights movement, not just of the welfare rights movement, also of the larger Black freedom movement, but one of their achievements was they forced the liberalization of the program known as AFDC, welfare. So benefits rose, the staff in welfare centers became somewhat more courteous and efficient. People were armed by their own sense of rights and by the fact that they had lawyers too from the welfare rights movement. But once the movement subsided, of course, the cuts began to roll in. Not only the nasty ways of talking about poor people, poor women trying to raise a bevy of kids on their own, but the cuts and the forced work programs and the range of ways to humiliate these women. I don't know if any of you remember how in New York City, when Rudolph Giuliani, you know, he hasn't always been Trump's lawyer, when he was the mayor of New York, he presided over the implementation in New York of the Personal Responsibility Act, which was welfare reform, but it was really welfare cuts. And the form that welfare cuts took is that, one form it took is that women were assigned to work crews in city government in New York. And you know, they were made to wear day glow vests as they worked on the side of roads or in the parks. What was that about? I think that was just like the denigration of welfare recipients of paupers in medieval England, where if people asked for a handout, they were tied to carts on market day, or they were branded. I mean, this is a form of public humiliation. And our political leaders have been doing that to poor people since the 1960s, really.
So part of the work that you did in the writing, that in particular that you did around welfare rights and how to expand welfare provision by disrupting the system, got a lot of attention after the 2008 financial crisis when it was discovered by one Glenn Beck. And it was very interesting because the Tea Party really loved disrupting things, right?
Yeah.
They were learning from you.
Well, but their idea of disruption was
not quite the same.
A lot of foul language and fake threats and things like that. I think what happened and what led to the Glenn Beck attacks on me, which I wasn't sorry about. I mean, it gave me a chance to speak. But the way it happened is that way back in the 1960s, there were people who associated with Commentary magazine, who neocons, in other words, there were people who were very angry at intellectuals who supported the black movement. And their argument was that the United States, under the leadership of the Democratic Party, not the New Deal Democratic Party anymore, but a much chastened and worn out Democratic Party without unions, that the United States was becoming a social democracy, and what was really dangerous and interrupting that progression was the black freedom movement. Now, they couldn't scold blacks. They couldn't scold blacks because they would be hooted at, but they could scold white intellectuals who supported the black movement. I think that David Horowitz was the informant for Glenn Beck. So, It was ridiculous. I was an old lady. They tried to depict me as a witch.
I heard you have a black cat.
I do have a black cat.
I'm just saying. I had a black cat too for a while.
Who was it that they actually engaged? I thought it was resentful people, middle-aged, maybe a little older, a little bit overweight, people who after dinner felt stuffed and went down to the rec room to play with their computers and clicked on The Blaze, Glenn Beck's newsletter, with all of its ridiculous charges. But he even said I was one of the 9 most dangerous people in the world.
I mean, that's a compliment.
What they also did, I have a little house about 100 miles north of the city. They gave directions for how to get to my house.
Yeah.
To angry deer hunter types and stuff like that. It was really nasty. But not as nasty as the policy of separating children from their parents at the border.
And those tactics, it turns out that they are still using and have perfected the art of trying to get people fired and all of those things. But I want to go from there to Occupy Wall Street, because this was, you know, Glenn Beck made you famous, and then Occupy Wall Street is like, hey, maybe we should check out her work. This seems like maybe useful. But I want to talk about particularly the idea, some of the ideas for disruption that came out of Occupy, not just occupying a park, but like debt strikes, things like that.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because a couple of times in the couple of days I've been here, I've heard people say that Occupy Wall Street failed. You know, I think that's a really wacky thing to say. Occupy Wall Street. How many people were down there? Well, it was a relatively small action. A few hundred people in a park. And there, I've been to a lot of Occupies in other cities too, and they were all like that, relatively small. Very nice, very friendly, very, and very talented. These kids, and they were mainly kids, were so good at doing what every movement tries to do, which is to communicate a critique of the society, and to communicate an alternative portrait of how we could live together. That's what movements, it's one of the things that movements do. They try to disrupt, they try to make things stop, but they also try to communicate, partly because they want to influence a broader public, and partly because they're always trying to get more people to join the movement. Occupy was so good at doing this. Come on, can't you remember how they changed political discourse in the United States? How many times have we written for little newspapers and for big newspapers and tried to change the discourse? That's what we always say we're doing. I've written so many books. Occupy had a much bigger impact on the public discourse than I did. Everybody knows what the 1% and the 99% are. Now, it's true that Occupy didn't do the whole job by any means. They had to get bigger, there had to be more people in the movement, and we had to make more trouble. We had to use our different kinds of strike power. But one group can't do everything. So we can't do it all at once. So there's much more to be done, and we're going to go on to do it, I think.
Yeah. And bringing that back around to today, we should note that I don't know exactly how many cities it's at right now, but there are Occupy ICE encampments at ICE offices around the country. In cities with liberal mayors that call them sanctuary cities, but you know, we know how that works. But so, I do want to talk about the movements of today. We had a wonderful plenary last night with the teachers from the struggle across the country. So, and I know there are more teachers talking right now, so we thank you all for being here with us. But yeah, I would love your thoughts on the revival of the strike, and particularly in these, you know, so-called red states. And we're seeing these teacher strikes ripple across the country.
Well, I loved it. I was so cheered by it, and I think you were too. But you know, so what lessons can we take from it? I think there are a couple. One is the teachers' unions did not organize the strike. We have to take the lesson of mass unorganized, relatively, we call it spontaneous. It's not really spontaneous. It's just an official organization isn't doing it. But we have to take from the teacher's strike a new confidence in the capacity of people to see their own power and to act on it. And even in a red state. But there's another lesson, I think. You know, the old left has always placed its confidence in industrial workers, workers in the mass production industries. The great blow that globalization struck to the labor movement was that globalization meant that investment in mass production could shift to low-wage parts of the globe. Everybody knows that problem. It was devastating, devastating for the industrial unions. And even though I'm critical for unions, I think we're much better off with unions. But notice who struck. It was teachers. And notice also how militant the nurses are. So even though they tell us, old-timers who want to discourage a youthful movement, they tell us that, and I've heard labor leaders say this, we can't talk about striking now. That's not quite true. We have to be careful when we talk about striking. We have to figure out who can strike. Who can't be replaced by a computer message that sends investment to Bangladesh? And that is teachers, nurses, all kinds of service workers, the nannies that take care of the kids, of the women who work now on Wall Street. A lot of people can't be replaced with the click of a computer. So it's not quite true that the workers' movement can't survive globalization and internationalization. It's just that we have to adapt in our strategies to the constraints and the opportunities created by globalization. And I said opportunities because I think that globalization also creates opportunities. Globalization means extended chains of production. Things are produced everywhere and they have to be coordinated. It's a very fragile system of transportation and coordination through computer programs. And think about the huge warehouse centers where all this stuff is dumped. And then it has to be fed out over the country, over highways and complicated systems of truck transportation. This is a very fragile system. You know, in the old days, labor leaders used to talk about logistical workers. They were very interested in logistical workers. Logistical workers were like dockers. They worked in the port because they could jam things up in the port. Now there are a lot of places where you can jam things up, and we've got to learn how to do that.
Now, keeping an eye on the clock here because I know are going to have some questions from the room, but I wanted to ask also, since we were talking about poor people's movements, the new Poor People's Campaign that has just been kicking off. And the idea of, once again, centering not just workers and the idea of workers, but actually saying we're going to talk about poor people and we're going to put poor people and their demands at the center of a movement.
Well, I take great cheer from the emergence of that movement. And I have one observation about it. You know, people sort of wonder why the poor aren't protesting right away, because of course they're the ones that feel the crunch of austerity politics first. And the reason is because they're most vulnerable. That's why. So one of the reasons that we should support protest movements elsewhere in the society is that it spreads, it gives people courage, it gives the poor courage. And we should also work with their movements. We should join their movements. I think we should join the Poor People's Campaign and support it with donations too.
So before I let everybody else ask, anything else, any other place that you're taking inspiration right now that we haven't already talked about?
I gotta think, I'll let you know.
let's see what we've got for questions, and then
we're trying to get off the
sun. I know, it's a little scary, it's a little sad.
I think that was great. We can all agree on that.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.